This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. What's the job outlook for new and recent grads? A forthcoming report from the left-leaning North Carolina Justice Center looks into that question, and it puts the millennial generation's employment and financial decisions into context. It shows how the workforce they entered was completely different from that of their parents. Alan Fryer directs the Workers' Rights Project at the center. Alan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Also with us, Brian Kennedy II, Public Policy Fellow in the Budget and Tax Center of the Justice Center. Hello, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Give us the bullet points now. What is the outlook if I'm a recent grad?
So the outlook is not as great as we would like. I think the big thing to know about millennials entering the job market now is that they've come of age at a time that is radically different than what their parents and grandparents experienced in two main ways. Now, these folks are about, millennials comprise about 40% of the state's workforce. So they have an outsized importance in what our economy looks like. They came of age and entered the labor market roughly right before and during the worst economic downturn since the 1930s. What that means is that they are today earning a little bit less than their parents did in the 1980s, once you adjust for inflation. So we're used to a job market where generation after generation makes consistently more money. That's just not happening here. A second related problem to that is that at the peak of the recession, millennial unemployment was about 22%. So almost one out of every four millennials didn't have a job. Now, we know that over the course of someone's working career, their starting salary has a lot to do with how much money they make by the end of their life. So this is an entire generation that came of age right at a point where their earning potential was crippled. If that's not bad enough or hard enough, the second major problem is that they've come of age in an era in which we've seen the culmination of 30 years of a very systematic disinvestment in the very programs that promoted upward mobility that their parents and grandparents got to experience. Spending on education, on higher education, on infrastructure, on affordable housing, the things that really made life cheap and affordable and livable for their parents in the 50s, 60s, and 70s are much, much, much more expensive now. And so it's a much more challenging environment for them. And I think that is the overall context that we looked at when we put this report together.
And those expenses didn't just happen. That's also a matter of public policy. Big changes in where we placed our investment, who were the beneficiaries of policies. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. But, Brian, there's a demographic breakdown here, too. These difficulties are not all shared equally, right?
That's absolutely true. One thing that's different about about the millennial generation as opposed to generations before is that those generations are becoming more increasingly made up of black and brown people, of communities of color. Additionally, we see more women continuing to enter the workforce. And we have not made the policy investments and the policy changes to best serve those populations. So, for example, we have underserved communities of color when it comes to our school, our nation's and our state's public education system. And so when we see those inequities continue from K-12 education or continue from the job market, and we see an increase in people of color and an increase in people entering into the labor force, those disparities are exaggerated even further.
Is it showing up in higher unemployment numbers too?
It absolutely is. This has been persistent throughout the recession. We've seen higher unemployment rates amongst communities of color. And we've seen lower, you know, there's a gender pay gap as well. Women in North Carolina make 86 cents to every dollar that men make. Black women make 64 cents and Latina women make 48 cents to every dollar that men make. So when we have these disparities, these racial and these gender disparities that were already present prior to the recession, and we on top of that, we put a lack of public investments, a changing workforce, contingent work, things like that, these disparities are even further exaggerated.
You talk about public investment, but there's another explanation abroad in the minds of many out there. Millennials just don't work as hard. They're slackers. They don't care about work. And by the way, they don't save very much.
Absolutely. We have to, one question that we have to ask, are the practices that millennials are participating in, are they a result of their own individual decisions, or are they a reaction to a changing workforce and a changing environment? So, for example, one thing we find are that millennials today actually save more money on average than their parents' generation before them. So the parents, when they were young adults, they saved around $3,500, an average of $3,500 in a savings account. Today, millennials have an average of $5,000 in their savings accounts. The difference, however, are that parents, their parents' generations actually had higher amounts of assets than the current generations. They also had a lower debt-to-income ratio. So today, the average millennial has a debt-to-income ratio of two, which means that for every $2 in debt, they have $1 in income.
And this is significant because if you want to do something like buy a house, which is one way that middle-class people traditionally had built wealth and been able to pass that on to the next generation, it's going to be hard to get a loan with that kind of a debt-to-asset ratio.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've seen the home ownership rate amongst millennials decrease. And multiple surveys have shown it's not that millennials don't want to settle down. It's not that they don't want to start families, purchase homes. It's that they don't feel like they're able to do so. That, in combination with the fact that we've seen stagnant wages over the past 30 years, creates a scenario where we have people who now make a majority of our workforce who cannot make the investments that their parents made, who won't be able to pass down the same types of wealth that their parents were passed down to them, who aren't going to be able to take entrepreneurship risk. And so it's drastically changing what options millennials have.
We've seen the steady decline of the middle class in the United States since the 1980s, when many of these policy shifts took place, to the point that the Pew Trust came out with a report just recently that said now the middle class comprises a minority of the American public. This means this is a significant marker, by the way, for economic and political stability. But talk more about the reasons and how we got here. You know, the promise of the Reagan administration going back to 80 is if you get the government off our back, you lower taxes, everything improves. And sure enough, corporate profits did improve and productivity more than doubled. And yet wages are stagnant. So that's one of the things we're looking at in terms of public policy, right, Alan?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I talk about this, I usually present it as a mystery. There is about $11 billion in worker compensation that's missing from the North Carolina economy that should be there if wages were growing at the same rate they were even 10 years ago. And so we asked this question, what happened to my $11 billion that would otherwise go to labor? And the mystery is very simple. Since the late 1970s, we've seen business productivity in North Carolina almost double. That means they're using technology and worker skills to produce more and more products at a cheaper and cheaper price for every unit of labor, for every worker. So the worker is then becoming more efficient, more productive, and ultimately more profitable for the company. Yet wages, as we've said, have remained stagnant. So our $11 billion is clearly missing in this hole. It turns out the Brookings Institute did a study 2 years ago that figured out where that $11 billion went and looked at where it went for the country. It turns out it went to three places. Those productivity gains that historically go to workers and better wages have gone to corporate executive bonuses and salaries. It has gone to additional investor income. And again, we recognize in America, the American corporation should provide income to its investors. But that's a very small amount of where this money went. 95 cents out of every dollar in productivity gains that the private sector has generated over the last 30 years has gone to corporate stock buybacks. It may seem very arcane, but what this really means is that corporations are buying their own stock in order to pad their stock price to show better quarterly gains for investors on Wall Street. So these buybacks don't actually do anything for the company. It's not investing in new plant. It's not investing in more workers. It's certainly not investing in higher wages for workers. Instead, it's this artificially inflated bubble that really has done nothing to help the American economy. So in other words, 95 cents out of every dollar is not going to labor. And over the long term, that's meant that workers have lower wages. They don't have the benefits that workers in other countries take for granted, like paid family medical leave or paid sick days. And so this is a long term problem for the private sector retreating from the kinds of jobs that their parents and grandparents had. But we have seen it exacerbated by policy decisions. There were a number of trade deals that were passed in the 1990s and early 2000s that doubtless lowered prices for goods from overseas, but at the same time offshored the American manufacturing jobs that used to produce those goods to other countries with lower labor costs. And in doing so, it created this real downward pressure on wages in the American manufacturing sector. And so there was very little incentive for big business in particular to invest in its workforce when in America, when it could very easily just move that workforce to cheaper places like Mexico and China. So millennials have come of age sort of at the apex of this 30 years of retreat from private sector jobs. From quality private sector jobs. And that has meant that there are not enough jobs available for them, hence their higher unemployment rate. And the jobs that they do have are just not the same kinds of jobs that their parents took for granted. And it's a tragedy, I think, that that for so many years we had seen progress in wage growth, progress in the creation of quality jobs. And in the last 30 years, we systematically dismantle the types of policies that would produce those jobs. And so I think policymakers really face a challenge now. And I think we saw that in the 2016 elections, the recognition that the system was not working for the average working person. And so policymakers need to figure out how to grapple with that.
Talking to Alan Fryer, Director of Workers' Rights Project at the North Carolina Justice Center, and Brian Kennedy II, a public policy fellow at the same North Carolina Justice Center. I want to thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And their report is called The State of Working North Carolina. It's going to be released on Saturday. You can find more details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, in the not-too-distant future, what will be the balance of human and machine in the workforce? We'll talk about that on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned.